Hello there, theater lovers. It's me, Bryn. Today we will be talking about The Wolves by Sarah Delap with Grace Walker. If you're on TikTok, especially theater TikTok, you know Grace. And you're probably excited because she's awesome. We had an amazing discussion about this play, and I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. But, as usual, our announcements first. As usual, check out The Tank if you want to watch some theater that you don't need to pay for or go anywhere to see. I always like to throw that out there because, you know, it's good to watch theater. Secondly, Soundscape had their Scarescapes Festival. It's ending, I believe, as this episode comes out, but you will still be able to go and listen to those plays on their Instagram, YouTube, or SoundCloud. Just search Soundscape Theater. Previous guest, Monica Cross, has two different virtual productions in the next few weeks. On Halloween, so 2 days from when this episode airs, her adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's The Mask of Red Death is part of an evening of Poe. It's called An Evening with Edgar Allan Poe. It is being produced by The Rude Mechanicals in Eastern Washington, though it is online. There is an Eventbrite. Let me see how I can tell you to find. If you search up on Eventbrite, An Evening with Edgar Allan Poe, you should be able to find it. You can sign up. Tickets are available through Eventbrite, as per usual, and they are free unless you would like to make a donation. The next show by Monica Cross that will be coming to your screens is called Cyrano on the Moon. This is going up with Whiskey Theater Factory, of course, online. Let me look. Tickets are available beginning November 7th, so very, very soon. You can go to whiskeytheaterfactory.com to find more information. And that is all for our announcements this week. So, buckle up and get ready to dive into the world of The Wolves by Sarah Delap. Sarah Delap's play, The Wolves, premiered off-Broadway at The Playwright's Realm, following an engagement at New York Stage and Film, and development at Club Thumb and Great Plains Theater Conference. The Wolves received the American Playwriting Foundation's inaugural Relentless Award and was a finalist for the Susan Smith Blackburn Prize and the Yale Drama Series Prize. Delap is the page one playwright for the Playwrights Realm and has been a resident artist at the Sitka Fellows Program and Space on Ryder Farm. Past affiliations include Clubbed Thumb's Early Career Writers Group and New George's Audrey Residency. Her current affiliations include Ars Nova's Playgroup and resident playwright at LCT3. Delap is in the process of getting her MFA in playwriting at Brooklyn College. A summary of The Wolves from New Play Exchange. Left quad, right quad, lunge. A girls' indoor soccer team warms up. From the safety of their suburban stretch circle, the team navigates big questions and wages tiny battles with all the vim and vigor of a pack of adolescent warriors. A portrait of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for 9 American girls who just want to score some goals. To understand this play, we really need to cover soccer, like the history of soccer in America as played by women. In my opinion, the game of soccer is a larger metaphor in this play for, you know, life and in general, so it's pretty important. Since the 80s, there has been an American women's soccer team chosen and sent to the Summer Olympics. However, they either never did very well or no one ever really cared that much. That changed in the 90s, however. In 1991, FIFA held the first ever Women's World Cup. And the American team won. Unfortunately, nobody back home in the U.S. seemed to care all that much. The team didn't have much money, and despite their absolutely fantastic win, like, look up the scores, it's insane, they were stuck in a sort of purgatory for almost 2 years. And now let's go back a little bit and look at what's happening outside of the Olympics. So, the first national women's soccer team in America, again, outside of the Olympic teams, wasn't formed until 1995. Yeah, you heard me right, only 26 years ago. They were first called the United States Interregional Women's League. The name later changed to W League, the W League. Women's League, you get it? Yeah. After this name change around 1997, the W League split into two separate organizations, the W League and the Women's Premier Soccer League. By 2000, both organizations were rendered to second tier, like minor league status level by the creation of the Women's United Soccer Association. After the U.S. women's national team won in the 1999 FIFA Women's World Cup, soccer became a lot more popular for young girls in America. Women's professional soccer teams began to pop up in major cities through the newly created Women's United Soccer Association. The girls of America began to catch the soccer bug. Unfortunately, the Women's United Soccer Association would be disbanded after 3 seasons due to financial troubles. It ultimately took the U.S. women's soccer team winning 3 World Cups, 3 of those FIFA Women's World Cups, in 1991, 1995, and 1999, for people to start caring. Why is that? The answer, like most things, is very complex, but a big part of it was, you probably guessed it, misogyny and sexism. I think we all have been aware at some point, even if you aren't into sports, that the U.S. women's soccer team has historically performed better than the men's. However, the pay gap between them is staggering. Many women on the team have come out in the past 5 years or so on social media, especially Twitter, I believe, to state their pay and win rate compared to the men's team. And, you know, showing that things just didn't add up. In fact, things were so bad that the women's team, at least 5 women from the team, filed a lawsuit against U.S. Soccer for gender discrimination in March of 2019. In May of 2020, the judge in this case dismissed it. Yep. Apparently, the contracts were negotiated differently between the men's and women's teams. They got paid differently. Women more on a salary-type basis, and men on every game they played. So I guess this means that they don't have to be paid equally? Okay. Anyways, the women appealed the decision this year, 2021, and things began to look a little brighter. Because the good news is, according to CNBC, this past September, last month as of recording this, the U.S. Soccer Federation agreed to renegotiate contracts so that men's and women's teams get paid the same way. And, more importantly, the same amount. It's important to note that The Wolves was developed and published before this decision, and so was written in a world where the gender pay gap in soccer was still enormous. This totally would have been something that each of these girls would have been aware of. This play isn't just about soccer, though. In fact, I'd say soccer is merely the backdrop for a story about growing up female-coded in a capitalistic and patriarchal world, and how that affects young people as they grow up. However, going into all that would probably take an absurd amount of time, so I'll just leave it with this. Women and femmes often are conditioned to feel that to succeed, they must compete with the femmes and women around them and beat them no matter the cost in order to get what they want. Hence that radical phrase that's appeared over the last few years, women supporting women. Don't worry, I'll discuss this more in depth with Grace in the interview section. But first, an ad read. And then our reading section. Lily Welsh is here to perform a monologue as number 25. But first, a word from our sponsor. And now, Lily Welsh performing as number 25.
We don't have time, okay? We don't have time! Okay, you know what? Everyone stretch. Right now. Yeah, okay, great. So let's talk about last week. We lost last week, right? Yeah, we did. To a team that was worse than we were. Why? Because we weren't listening to each other. I'm sorry, am I interrupting? Good. Now this week we're playing a good team, but we beat them before, okay? So we know they're good, and sure, they are. They're really good. They went to Nationals last year, right? But are we scared? I said, are we scared? That's right. We're not scared. We're ready to play. Because this isn't about last year's Nationals. This isn't about next year's Nationals. This is about right here, right now, in City Sports Dome. So expect a lot of shots on goal, which means mark your man, watch for breakaways. We're going to play 2-2-1. I want Aiden Miandi, 14 and 11, in midfield. But I want you guys to hang back. And 46 is on striker. 7 and 13 will sub you in fast. It's going to be a running game, so we'll be switching it up constantly. They're really going to run us out there. And everybody watch for Jordana. But hey, this is all coming from coach. Hey! We're a team. You want to play? You play with us. All of us, okay?
Thank you so much, Lily, for that amazing performance. If anyone would like to contact Lily with professional inquiries, her contact information can be found in the show notes of this episode. And now I'd like to welcome Grace Walker to the podcast. Grace Hello. Is a, yeah, hi. She's a dramaturg, an actor, an arts administrator, and an emerging playwright who has studied this play extensively. If you follow her on TikTok, which you should if you don't, she's made a lot of content just about theater in general, but also about this play, which is kind of how we met. So I figured yes. She'd be perfect to come on and talk about this play. So
hello, yeah, everyone. Hi. So I really just like cut in. I was like, hi, I'm so excited to talk about this play. I really love it. I am literally Sarah DeLapp's biggest fan. She might get a restraining order from me because I am so obsessed. Just kidding. But like, you know, I am obsessed with this play. It's amazing.
Yeah, I had read it once when I was in grad school because we were doing it at Sarah Lawrence and I wanted to see what the hype was about. And then Sarah DeLapp came and talked to us. So I was like,
so jealous.
Yeah, I was like, I have to read this. And then I was really, really intrigued by what you had to say about it on the TikTok.
Thank you.
So I wanted to learn more. And I figured there's a lot of people out there who probably want to learn more about it too. From hearing you, but also because this play, guys, I don't know if I mentioned in the dramaturgy section, I did, is Pulitzer Award nominated.
Finalist, yes.
Yeah, as a finalist. And another fun fact y'all probably don't know, this was her first play.
Insane.
Yeah, as a playwright, I'm a little like, oh my God.
And I could be wrong. Chances are I might be, but like I remember somebody telling me that she wrote this in like 3 weeks or something.
What?
Which, like, how do you write a play like this in 3 weeks? I'm just like, the talent.
Yeah, I'm unbelievable. Like, I write a crappy first draft in 3 or 4 weeks, sure, but not what?
Like, it's crazy. It's so good.
Yeah, and to be written, like, if you go on her new play exchange, which I did for mm-hmm. research, this is the only play she has listed.
Mm-hmm.
It is the only one. And I'm amazed. I know, Grace, you were saying earlier she's been commissioned by mm-hmm. multiple theaters to write something. And I think we're all anxiously awaiting the sequel to this play, and we're about to tell you why.
honestly, like, I know she's probably feeling the pressure because this play did so well, but it's like she could write 3 words on the back of a receipt and I would read it. Like, it doesn't matter what the next play is. Like, I'm sure whatever it is, I will be a fan of it, because it's just the way that she views theater is really fascinating. And I just fully support her no matter what she does. I just want her to know that, because I feel like there must be so much pressure. But yeah, she really shouldn't feel that way, because I think so many of us who really love this play, we just love the way that she just views theater. And, like, whatever comes next, I don't know, I'll be happy with whatever. I really will be.
Yeah, and speaking as a playwright, that's so lovely to hear. I will just say that's lovely to hear. it's good to know there are always going to be people out there who are going to read the 3 words he wrote on the back of a receipt.
Absolutely. I'm the kind of person, like, I just love what playwrights do, so it doesn't matter what you write. Like, I'll just be there. I'm such a fan.
Well, I love to hear that. I love to hear that. And I'm sure if for some weird reason Sarah Dunlap ever listens to my podcast, it would be insane. She will be very, very happy to hear that from you. I am sure she will.
She's already like, stop talking about me on your TikTok. Like, she's like, why are you so obsessed with this one play, girl? Like, move on.
Stop making TikToks about me.
She's going to be like, I do not want to be on the interweb.
She is very private. It was actually kind of hard for me to find a bio about her. And I will mention right now, just before I forget, what I found said she was still in the middle of getting her MFA at Brooklyn College in playwriting, but that might not be true. She might have already finished that. But like I said, she tends to be very private. So even her new play exchange bio is a little outdated, I think. Anyways, Brooklyn College playwriting has turned out a lot of amazing people, Sarah Dunlap being one of them. So if you're into playwriting.
Claire Barron being another.
Yeah, I love Claire too. You're going to be jealous of me again. I actually did You Got Older with her.
Are you serious? Wait, do you know, maybe you, I don't know if you know, but do you know Colleen Sullivan?
Yeah, really well.
She was my director for The Wolves.
She was my director for You Got Older.
Shut the front door. Are you serious?
I am serious. I went to Sarah Lawrence on her recommendation. Because she wrote my recommendation letter for Sarah Lawrence College, and I went to Make Trouble with her because she runs Make Trouble.
That's so funny. Yeah. She teaches at AU, and, like, I love her to pieces. And I would go to her office hours and be like, tell me how Claire Barron does what she does, because I just want to know how to do that.
Like, I love her.
Oh my God. She's amazing.
That's actually really funny, because she was at Gettysburg for a semester, and then she went to American. I completely forgot about that. The year she was at Gettysburg, she did You Got Older with us, and I was Jenny.
That's incredible. Oh my God.
And Claire came for a week, and we just, like, had rehearsals with her and chilled with her.
That's amazing. No, because I know she worked on the original production of You Got Older.
Mm-hmm.
Either
the second production ever of You Got Older.
Damn, that's insane. Yep. That's awesome. It's such a good play.
I was honestly, to this day, even it's one of my favorite roles, solely because we got to interact with Claire so much for that week. That was amazing. I wish I had known then that I wanted to be a playwright so I could have picked the hell out of her brain. But anyways, Sarah Dunlap.
Back to Sarah Dunlap. So sorry. Oh,
so sorry, everybody.
What a small world, though, honestly.
Really, for real, if anyone out there, if any of you young people out there want to get into theater, here is your proof. When your theater teachers tell you it's a small world,
it is.
It is. Like, I know you don't believe it now because I didn't, but it really is. It really is such a small world. So, like, yeah, be nice. Be kind. Be gentle.
I don't know why, but when you said, like, yeah, I worked on the, like, one of the first productions that Sarah, I was like, I feel like she might know Colleen. I don't know why, but I just feel like she might.
Yeah, I haven't seen her in a while, but I keep up with her as much as I can. But that's it. Everyone, connections aren't everything, but they are nice. Sometimes.
I'm going to have to message her and be like, just so you know, you're on a podcast.
Yeah, just so you know, we talk about you on a podcast. Oops. Anyways. Oh my gosh. We should get into this play before everyone out there starts a riot. So let's start at the top. So the characters in this play.
Let's go.
Let's start from there. They don't go by names. And we're only made aware of their names at like the very end of the play. And you have to be paying attention to like catch them and place them to specific people. They are called by their numbers in the script and by each other. So I was wondering, like, there's got to be some dramaturgical importance of this. And do their specific numbers have any correlation to their characterization, to like who they are? What do you think?
Well, when I first read the play, I thought it was really cool how they were known for their numbers. And you only really get to know the names of two characters at the end. And that's 7 and 14, which is like really interesting. Like, why is it only those two? Which is just like a whole entire rabbit hole that we could get into. But I think with the numbers specifically, you know, these girls, they're in a space where they're really known for like the sport they play and for what they do. And so I think the reason why Sarah DeLapp, I mean, I can't speak for her, but I feel like part of the reason why she wanted the players to be known for their numbers, it's because she wants them to be known as soccer players before anything else, because that's their identity in this space. And I think that's really powerful, you know, like to be known for what you do. It's a little girl boss, but it's also really fun too. Like, I think that's a really cool concept. And I also think what's really cool about the numbers as well is that like, it really makes sense. Like when you look at 7, she's absolutely a 7. And, you know, maybe that's because of like our relationship with like the 7 deadly sins. And she definitely participates in a lot of them. But like, it's also just her vibe. She is a 7. 25 is a 25. 13, absolutely a 13. You know, like 2 definitely exemplifies like the insecurity of the character too. You know, I don't know how to describe it, but it's just, these numbers really encapsulate who these characters are. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, it almost makes me want to look into the numerology or some crap of the numbers. Oh, yeah. Because there's got to be, feel like there would be something there maybe.
Well, I played 7 in my college production. And I remember looking into that in the beginning. But then, like, Colleen was just sort of like, yeah, I mean, I feel like that's not really the main focus of this character. And she was right, because there are so many conflicting things out there about numbers, right? Like, there were articles I read where they were like, yeah, like 7 is a very godly figure. And I was like, I don't think 7 is godly, but.
Yeah, it's usually called a lucky number, which is kind of funny because I wouldn't call her lucky.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd call
her. I wouldn't call a lot of these characters lucky.
No. And like, number 13 has a connotation of being unlucky, but I don't know that 13 is the most like unfortunate in any way.
I would say she's probably the character. I mean, I would say 7 is very lucky in terms of her level of privilege, because she's definitely like way more wealthier than a lot of the other characters in the play. With 13, I think she's unlucky in the way where, like, at least in our production, we saw 13 as the character who, like, you know, wasn't the best soccer player. I feel like you could interpret it differently, but, like, she doesn't really get called out or anything. So it seems like for her, this is something that she likes to do, but it's not necessarily, like, the thing that she's really, really good at.
The thing that's going to take her to college, like, with so many of these girls.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That makes sense then. Yeah. It also feels like kind of an incomplete number to me. Usually threes, like, or just the number 3 feels kind of okay. Like, yeah. But 13, 23, like things that ended, it feels like you're just trying to get to 5. You know?
That absolutely. And 13 just feels like a wacky number. You know, like, it's like a very weird, it's also just a very weird age. Like, when you think of the age 13. It's just so uncomfortable and weird. And I just feel like 13, the character, is just like weird, like in the best way possible, she's wacky.
Yeah, she's a little, to refresh on this, I read the play and then I watched a version of the play online with the script beside me. To like fully get it. Cause to those of you who have read this play or want to read this play, it can be a little confusing on your very first read to see it without a visual, because a lot of the girls, like a lot of people do, talk over each other. So it can sometimes be like, oh, ah, ooh, ah. So I watched it, and 13 was very bubbly and like, okay, we're here. Ah, like,
yeah,
kind of personality. And it kind of, you're right, I don't know, something about it fit with 13.
For sure.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I like to analyze things too much.
No, I mean, it's so easy to sort of get caught up in the numbers. And I do think, like, you really can go down that rabbit hole and find a reason for each character. Yeah. Like, for me, like, the seven deadly sins really made sense for seven. But, yeah, I mean, I think, for me, I just think the focus of the numbers, it's like, yeah, they are soccer players. And that's how they see themselves in this space.
Yes.
And isn't it cool that they don't have to be anything else? Like, they don't have to be, you know, cute and fun Alex who's like flirting with her boyfriend. She can be Seven, the soccer player who takes her sport seriously. And that's so exciting.
Yeah. And, you know, 25 can be the captain or coach almost. And, you know, we have Double Zero who can't even talk till the end of the play because of social anxiety. Who, yeah. I mean, that's a whole thing that you could talk about.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think what's really interesting, going back to the numbers, right? Like, throughout the script, there are so many moments where Sarah Dunlap finds a way to call them something else. So when they have a conversation about 14's Armenian heritage, like, the minute she leaves, they call her, like, Armenian girl or something like that. I forget. But they refer to her as that, right? So it's like she finds ways to give these characters nicknames in a way that doesn't feel contrived or like forced, but it does feel reasonable and understandable so that they're not calling each other by their names.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think you're right that the significance of those numbers is to give them an identity that is separate from everything else. It is just their soccer identity. Which... I guess you could talk a lot about the identity too in this play. That could be a whole rabbit hole that I think we'll probably end up going down here in a second. because like they talk about so many things. They talk about themselves, obviously. They're people. But they also talk about like current events, or at least they were current when the play was written. Now they're like 2 or 3 years old, I think. And they talk about it as they're warming up and they're just like shooting the shit and whatever, because, you know, they're just warming up with their kids. And I felt that that provided like contrast and context for what the girls are going through outside of soccer, which is interesting now that we're talking about the identity and the so how did you view the inclusion of those discussions dramaturgically?
Yeah, I thought it was really exciting when you first start the play and they're talking about these really serious issues, especially talking about Cambodia and like, you know, and all of these like issues that when I was, you know, 16, 17 years old, like, I don't know if my friends and I were talking about that. Like, we talked about some serious things, but we certainly weren't that intellectually like, you know, stimulated at that age in our conversations. But like, I think what's so exciting about looking at this generation, right, especially people who are younger than us, even, it's like they have these really important conversations that need to be had. And they're so freaking smart because it's like we have so much access to information nowadays. And, you know, I see teenagers on TikTok like talking about theory that I didn't even know existed when I was 17 years old, and they know about it better than I do, you know? And it's like, it's really cool to see. And I think so many people underestimate teenage girls. And what's really great about this show is that it shows you just how like powerful and how intelligent they are and strong. And like, you know, it's not just, they're not just physically strong, which you see in the play because they're, you know, doing all of these warm-ups, but they're intellectually strong as well. And they do have an understanding of the world around them. And they're not just talking about boys, but they're really talking about the world in general. And I think that's a really empowering thing to see on stage.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Because you would think a show about a sport would focus very much on the physical aspect, on the physical realm. But right from the start, I think it's, I literally have the play up, so I should maybe look. Yeah, is like they start off talking. I think it is about Cambodia. It's about the they keep mispronouncing the name of the group.
Khmer Rouge. Yeah.
Yeah. Or one of them, a few of them keep mispronouncing the name.
Mm-hmm. 14 cannot get it down. She's like, what?
The who, what? Yeah, no, literally from the beginning, they are talking, like, the second line in the play is, he murdered thousands of people.
Yeah. Oh, wait, it's not 14 who mispronounces it. It's, who is it? I think it might be 13.
Yeah.
And then 14 calls her out for it. Sorry, I had to correct myself there.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you're right. It says right here. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, from the beginning, you would think they'd be talking about, you know, some, I think it breaks expectation from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And it dives you into this world, mm-hmm. which is really exciting as well. Like, you don't really have a minute to, you're just in it.
All of a sudden, we are watching these girls. They're warming up for a game and they're just talking. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea where the conversation started, how it started. I think we learned later that it might have been about homework at mm-hmm. some point. But the fact that we're just dropped in and they're not talking about the game, they're not talking about, I don't know, what do people stereotypically think teenage girls talk about, boys or whatever, which is also very heteronormative, but like, and they're not talking about those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, what's really exciting too, is that like, it's not, I think when we say that, right, like it seems like they don't engage in romantic relationships or whatever, but they do mention it throughout the play. Like, you know that Seven has a boyfriend, you know about Kevin, you know about like all of these other guys, but at the end of the day, it's not the main focus. Because like, yeah, of course it's a part of your life when you're growing up, but it's not, the main focus is what you love to do and your friends. Like when I was that age, yeah, my friends meant everything. I mean, they still do, but I think in a way where it's like they really influence everything that you do. Yeah. Especially when you're feeling insecure and you're feeling all of these emotions, you know?
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I'm so glad I'm not a teenager anymore. But
thank God.
Yeah. Because you're right. Because 25, even we learn, she doesn't officially ever say it, but we do learn she's gay or at least queer by the end of the play. And they do talk about boys and stuff. That's definitely there, but it's not the focus and it's not the only thing. In fact, their relationship to each other and their identity as a team, I think, is a lot more important to their discussions. Yeah. And I mean, when they talk about these current events, too, they don't always agree with each other.
Yeah.
They don't always
they get into some fights.
Yeah. No, especially like even in the first little bit there, they're talking about this guy or whatever, the Khmer Rouge, who killed like thousands of people. I don't know exactly if it's thousands or probably. I should have researched that. Oops. But and they're talking about, does he deserve the death penalty, even though he's like 90?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are like, he did something horrible, of course. But then some people are like, but he's old now. What's the point? Life in prison is 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
So
and then Zero, I think at the end, she says like, what does she say? She says that she thinks he should get the death penalty.
Yeah. She's like what he did was horrible and he deserves to be punished for it regardless of how old he is, basically. Not in that phrasing, but basically I'm like frantically scrolling through my digital copy to see if I can find it. The Cambodian, he deserves it. Even if he's weak, he deserves it.
Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see her say that and then to see where she goes later on in the play and how she discovers, like, you know, that like there's more to life than just being like rules all the time, you know? I think it's a really like I love Zero's journey because I just think it's so fascinating. And I think a lot of people, you know, especially like as an actor, right? Like some people may look at the script and be like, she doesn't say much, but she goes through, I think, the biggest change in the play. She's the hardest character, I think, to play because she's like,
it's all physical.
She has to emotionally and physically exhaust herself at the end of the play. But throughout the show, she has to listen the entire time. And there's multiple conversations going on. Yeah. Like, which ones is she listening to? I don't know. But she has to make that decision. And it's
exactly.
I just, the person who played Zero in our production, I was honestly so floored by their performance every night because it was just like, it's such a hard role, you know, and they absolutely killed it. But
I think people associate lines with, I don't know, the amount of lines with the amount of difficulty mm-hmm. sometimes, which is not no. not really the thing. No, acting is a very, very physical art, and that has the most physical thing to it. I mean, there's that whole nonverbal scene that Double Zero has in like the middle of the play mm-hmm. where she basically has like a panic attack, freak out in the middle of the field by herself.
Yeah. And the script says like she physically, she works out mm-hmm. so hard to the point where her entire body is just like done by the end of it. Mm-hmm. And to put your body through that is just like, that's a lot, you know, to ask an actor to do.
Yeah.
in the first place. But it's just also to watch somebody do that on stage and to see the different levels in which they engage in that, right? Like, it's just so, it's really beautiful to see and also very disturbing to see at the same time.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think some audience members probably have trouble looking at the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It feels so private, like you shouldn't be looking at it.
Yeah.
So at least that's how I felt watching watching the version I watched recently. I was like, Jesus, I feel like I shouldn't be watching this.
Mm-hmm. I really love that scene because I feel like, especially in sports, we require people to put their bodies through so much and there's so much pressure. And, you know, we ask people to break down their bodies in order to perform and to play these sports. Yeah. And it's just like, the amount of, you know, I don't know, it's such a crazy thing that we do, right? And I think from a, like, I'm a disabled actor, and so from my perspective, it's just like, so it's, yeah, like that is a I'm not making any sense, but that's like a huge part of sports, you know?
No, I understand, like, well, you know, disabled over here as well, and I get what you're saying. I understand. And it's like, also, let me get my thoughts together. Because this setting of a sports team is obviously, there's a very social, like, specific thing that we think about. There's very specific social norms to being within a team. But it's also, like, sports is this very physical thing that I think a lot of people naturally associate with cis men.
Mm-hmm.
But we are watching women, which, I mean, no one ever says if they're cis or not. They're just girls. So we don't know, but we're watching girls do this thing. And I don't know, I found that the setting of this team was like a really good metaphor, to me at least, of how non-cis men experience patriarchy, and because they're supposed to be on the same side. Mm-hmm. But they feel like they still have to compete against each other to like get recognition from like the college scout and to get validation from each other. And it's like almost a microcosm of the non-male experience, at least in America. I can't speak for other countries. So like, how did you view that? Like, both as an actor inside of it and as someone who just loves this play?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting to look at the competition between the girls. I think it's really heartbreaking when they're all looking at the scout and they're all watching, they're like watching their friends get, you know, seen, and they're just watching and they can't really do anything. And this is their dream. And it's like, I think especially working in the theater industry, especially being a young actor, like anybody can relate to that, right? Like watching yep. somebody else get an opportunity that you desperately want mm-hmm. and how heartbreaking that can be. When I watched the Lincoln Center production, and it was something that I started to see more and more as we got closer to our performance. And then it was like, it made sense to me. But in the beginning, mm-hmm. you know, really watching those other players talking to the scouts, like I didn't fully understand how heartbreaking that was to Seven, but throughout the show, like she desperately wants this. Like she just wants to be the best player. That's really what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are so many lines throughout the show where Seven says things like, you know, my pain tolerance is like, you know,
yeah,
it's fine. Totally fine. And like, mm-hmm. I don't feel pain. And she's very defensive about everything. And mm-hmm. she doesn't really show you much. And so I think that moment when she sees this, the scout, and she's like, you know, I've been playing on this team for this long. Yeah. And like, 46 just comes and she's like,
amazing.
She's amazing. And there's nothing I can do about it. It's just so heartbreaking because she puts in all of this work, you know?
Yeah.
And even though she is not always the best, you can definitely empathize with these characters when they're watching their friends, you know, going ahead. And I think also, especially like with 8, when she like looks at all of them, she's like, congratulations. And you just see how hard it is for her to say that. Like, yeah, I think that's very true for a lot of women. You know, you feel like you're constantly competing with everyone else because there's not enough space for you. But I think we actually can grow and become even better when we realize that, like, there is enough space. We just have to make more space for each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole women supporting women thing. It doesn't have to be like a weird toxic boss babe thing. It can be a real thing.
Exactly. It can be a
real thing. And I think that's what they ultimately come to at the end is like they've gone through all of this trauma, really, at each other's hands, but also not at all, just at the hands of the world. And they still at the end decide that they want to work together.
And how much they like really need each other, you know? It's like, at the end of the day, the sport is there, but it's not everything.
What they really missed was being on, working together, not what they were working on together, just being together, working towards something together.
And even when they're disagreeing, like they're still in unison. Like there's this thing where it's like the movement is constantly, they're all together, you know, it's all in unison. So it's just like, when you see that on stage, I think it's really powerful because you realize even when they disagree, they're still together.
Yes. Moments of unison can be really, really powerful, I think. Especially in live aspect, in a live theater, I think this can be really, yeah, it shows a lot and it connects them even when nothing else does. Which I think is why I saw it so metaphorically after, especially after like my third, like going through it, was because I saw that, because in our world today, we are all intrinsically connected. Like we can't say we are, we have the internet for Christ's sake. Like, and women have, a lot of us, or people, honestly, just anyone who isn't a cis male, we all have some very overlapping experiences that I think, I don't know, they connect us, and it's important to remember that when everything else is trying to tell us that we need to compete against each other and, you know, tear each other down to get up one step in the ladder because that's the only way to do it, because that's the only way the men see you or whatever. So I'm rambling now, but yes.
No, you're right. And I think also just the way that like they carry the movement and how like Sarah DeLapp describes it as following military precision. Like the movement should follow that sort of style.
Yeah.
And I think that's so interesting because it does feel like they're kind of going out to war every time they're like preparing for a game. It's like they're getting ready to really like fiercely attack this other team. And, you know, there's something really cool about seeing women just being like very fierce, but not combative towards each other, but just like, I'm here and I'm taking up space and like, I am worthy and I am ready to play.
Yeah. And I'm going to keep fighting to continue taking up space too.
Yes. And I think that's the big, for me, at least one of the big messages of the play is like this idea that you can keep moving on and you can keep on going even when you think like the world is ending, life still keeps going on and like you still have to show up. And I think these women constantly show up for each other even if they are disagreeing or whatever, like even when, you know, spoiler alert, 7 tears her ACL, like she shows up because she has nowhere else to go. Like this is her team, this is her family.
She's like, where else would I be on a Saturday morning? Like, doesn't
exactly
like where else would she, what would she do? You know, like, and I'm not a sports person, spoiler alert. I would see like my friends who were into sports or like my brother, like when teammates were injured, they would always still go to the game for like moral support and stuff. And I was like, why do they do that? They can't play. What's the point of them being there? And obviously now that I'm older, I understand why they were there. Mm-hmm. And Alex exemplifies that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously they have a huge blow up fight and they're like, are we even going to show up to the next game? And then when they show up and then another tragedy happens, which I mean, we're going to talk about. It's the elephant in the room here. 14 mm-hmm. Has an accident and she passes away. We have to piece together what happened specifically from what the girls kind of say out of the blue, interjecting into the middle of conversations, like as they remember, or when soccer mom comes in for that last, like, oof monologue. We put together that, like, she was running. She was on a run because they're, you know, they're athletes who play a sport in which running is very important. So mm-hmm. she's running a lot. She has headphones on and someone hits her with her car.
Yes.
And yeah. It's tragic as hell for obviously multiple reasons. And I'm still not sure exactly how Sarah Dunlap wanted me to feel about it, because obviously it's horrifying and tragic. And I felt a mixture of things. But why do you think she chose to end the play with the rest of the team, like, recovering from this tragedy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I listened. It was interesting. I listened to another podcast about this, and mm-hmm. I was raging mad. I mean, no offense. They have their opinion. They were men, obviously. And they were like, yeah, like, what was that ending? Like, what the heck? Like, they did not understand it. And mm-hmm. I was like, I think the ending is so brilliant because this whole show, right? Like, they're just talking about their lives. And it's kind of like nothing really important happens, right? Until the end. And until, like, you really see the relationship with, like, 7 and 14. But, like, for the most part, they're really just talking about their lives. But the way that Sarah Dunlap writes this, it's just so interesting. And, like, the way that she builds up the language, it's like, it feels like an orchestra, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it really does. When you listen to the way that these girls talk and when they interject and all this, it's like, it's a piece of music. And then seeing the movement on top of that, it's so interesting to watch on stage. And I think throughout the entire show, they're like, they're overlapping each other and they're constantly yeah. talking over each other. And they're trying to, like, take up all this space. And then at the end, that last scene, there is so much space that is not being filled. And there are so many things that they are not talking about. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know who it is until 7 shows up. Like, you have no idea who Megan is until yeah. like 7 shows up on stage. And I think it's interesting because I've talked to other 7s about this, about that moment when, like, you know, you walk on stage and everybody realizes who it was. 14. Mm-hmm. And some audiences, you know, they're like, oh, because of course, you know, 7 has been terrible to everyone. Mm-hmm. And then other audiences really do feel for 7 because they're like, the last thing you said to her was, I hope you fucking rot, you know?
Yep.
Which is horrible. Like, that is not the last thing. I mean, I guess some people could infer that, like, she talked to 14 at another point. But in our production, we thought it was the last conversation they had.
That's what I assumed.
Yeah. And it's really heartbreaking, you know, because it's like just looking at all these characters and seeing that they don't really know what to do next, but they know they have to show up for each other. And yeah. I think when you go through something, right, that's so, like, when you go through something like that, when you lose somebody who you really love, mm-hmm. what do you say? You know, what can you say? And I don't think anybody knows. And I think it's really interesting to see these 17, 18-year-olds trying to grapple with loss for the first time in their lives, you know? I mean, 8, like, dealt with the loss of her mother, but mm-hmm. she's really the only one who seems to have an understanding of that.
Yeah, and to top it all off, 14 is their age.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other layer.
Mm-hmm. And I do think it's interesting. I mean, some people say it's so random, right? Like, her being the one who dies at the end. But, like, at the beginning of the play, she's the one who coughs first. She gets sick first. And then they all get sick later. And then she's the one who dies at the end. So there is sort of this, there's this little hint that it's going to happen, right? Like, she's the first one affected by this virus that is going on and affecting the rest of the team. And then at the end, she's the one who really
pays the price for the virus, I guess, if you could. I mean, not really, but you know what I mean? It's like this idea that like it starts with her and then
it ends
the tragedy affects her at the end. So it's really interesting to see how it happens. And I love the ending because I think there are so many shows out there that try to show death as like some sort of, oh, it happened because of this, it happened because of that. But like so many times in life, death just happens and it's random and it's horrible and it's upsetting. And like, that's just the reality of life. It's just,
yeah,
it can be random and there's no reason why it just happens. And I really love that Sarah DeLapp shows that in this play.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, my first instinct when I figured out, oh, someone's dead, was that it had been a suicide, because that seems to be the only death that's really shown in theater a lot, which is really weird.
I also thought the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And then to find out that it was completely an out of the blue accident. We don't know anything about the driver. All we know is that he didn't defrost his windshield, so maybe he couldn't see her, and that's why. Mm-hmm. Like, he wasn't even drunk or anything. Like, there's absolutely no, like, quote-unquote lesson to take from her death at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so, you wouldn't think it's so radical to write that, but I guess it is, because I was surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also really interesting to see who has changed because of the death and who hasn't. Mm-hmm. When I was in the show, my director really wanted me to not change. And I remember the like Aristotelian actor in me was like, what do you mean? Like, she's heartbroken. Her best friend just died. And she was like, but Seven doesn't show her cards. And there's also, I mean, in the script, like there are, I think a lot of Sevens actually do break down at the end, right? Mm-hmm. So it totally makes sense for that to happen and for that to be the reality. And there were definitely shows where like I would break down just because it felt so real.
Yeah.
And as somebody who's like lost people in my life, like, yeah, that scene really affects you because you do feel it when everyone's looking at you and they're like, are you okay? I can't really ask you though. Right. And then 46, like asking Seven, are you okay? After everything, it's just like so heartbreaking. But I think what Seven says at the end, right, she's just sort of like, I'm okay. I don't really want to talk. Like, she doesn't really talk about it.
Yeah.
And so there's definitely, I mean, you could choose it either way. But I thought that was so interesting to look at it from that perspective of like, yeah, does Seven change? Like, does she finally sort of like break down? Do we start to see her?
Yeah.
And like, how does that affect the audience if she doesn't? Right. Because there are so many things that happen in adolescence that like, you know, you want people to change, but a lot of times people don't. Some people just like stay shitty. I think that's what's really interesting, especially when you look at the characters, because for Zero, she changes, but is it because of 14's loss or is it because she, you know, really like dealt with all of her pain on the soccer field? For 25, it definitely influenced her. Like, it influenced a lot of characters, but who does it not influence? I don't know. I think it's really interesting. And I think it differs for every production.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, I love scripts that can be interpreted a multitude of ways, and I think this is one of them, and that's one of its strong points.
Absolutely. It's the kind of ending that just makes you feel like I remember watching the Lincoln Center production because they were live streaming it at one point, and I was just like, that ending, like, you don't know how to feel. It just breaks you in half because there's no resolution. And it's just, I think it's so cool because you normally don't see that from plays. And it just, there's something that feels so, it just feels like a very feminine structure. The whole show does. And I really love that about it.
Oh, I've talked about feminine structure quite a bit in the podcast. So I won't bore everyone with it again, but yeah. I think a lot of people associate the typical climactic structure of Western storytelling to be very male, and it's very refreshing when we see stories told that don't follow that typical climactic structure.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very refreshing.
And I think especially with the ending when when Sarah Delap says in the stage directions, they come together in like a Bacchic sort of style.
Yeah.
I remember my director being really like interested in that phrasing. She was like, Bacchic, like, oh my, what does that mean? You know? And it's really cool to see that because, yeah, I think when you're young, right, like so much of the pain that you experience and so much of the trauma that you experience, you don't really like emotionally feel it out all the time. Sometimes you're literally just keeping it hidden in and you're just like, it can come out whenever, right? And so seeing mm-hmm. these girls kind of like cheering together and coming together and then letting it release in that sort of like fierce and epic way, mm-hmm. it's just really cool to see on stage and yeah. very truthful, I would say.
Oh yeah, no, it feels like a very honest moment. And that Bacchic word, I mean, I just imagine the Bacchae, the play, the Bacchae.
Right, yeah.
And how like it's women going kind of crazy, but are they really crazy or are they just like quote unquote acting like men, i.e. not being docile? Mm-hmm. So it's like there's a whole thing just in that one word that she chooses right. to use there. And with the fact that these are young women or young mm-hmm. like young femme identifying people. And she's using the word Bacchic with them. So yeah. That's a whole dramaturgical moment right there.
Right.
In that one word.
Absolutely.
Which is one of the amazing things about this play. Mm-hmm. That like you can honestly, I could have made my dramaturgy section like 30 minutes long. You all would have hated me though. So I didn't do that. I kept it under 12 minutes like I usually try to do. Because you can pick a random page and probably find something that you're like, oh, I could, like, there's so many meanings to that. I could look up the current event they're talking about, or I could look up, you know, this random word usage. So much.
Well, and what's so cool is, like, looking at their dialogue, they all have some sort of saying that they, like, constantly repeat, which I love. Like, mm-hmm. I forget which character it is, but somebody says, like, can I just, and they keep saying that. And then with Seven, she says the F word at least 64 times, I think. I counted it one time. She constantly drops the F bomb. And so they have these like little sayings that they use throughout the show. And it tells you so much about who they are. But they all have like a certain thing that they rely on, right? And so mm-hmm. I just think it's really cool to see how they, I don't know, just their speaking patterns. Like it's very specific and it's so smart on Sarah's behalf because mm-hmm. these are really fleshed out characters and they do reveal a lot about themselves throughout the show, but you don't mm-hmm. always realize it. Like, you know, you see how 8's mom, like losing her mom, how that really impacted her. Mm-hmm. You see 13 talking about her relationship with the coach and like, it's not something that you would instantly pick up, but like,
Yeah,
it totally yeah. makes sense, you know? When Seven talks about her relationship with her father and how she like yells about I think it's she starts like yelling about immigration and everybody is like, why are you so passionate about this? And she's like, I've heard my dad talk about it. And that tells you so much about how, you know, she interprets frustration and anger and how she copes with it. And I just think that's really interesting. And that was something when I was working on the play that was really interesting to me because, like, you know, I tend to play a lot of, like, really aggressive characters. And which is, like, interesting because I'm not really, like, I don't know. I'm not that aggressive of a person. I don't think I am. like, I'm pretty bubbly and, like, friendly when you meet me. But, you know, I think that, like, being raised in my family, right, with, like, mm-hmm. with my brother and my dad – and hearing the way they speak, like that absolutely influences the way that I approach these characters. And, you know, my parents are amazing people. They're not like, they're fine. But it's just like, yeah, when you hear men in the way they speak, mm-hmm. you can absolutely take that tone and adapt it to other characters or to the way that you express your frustration. And like when I was in high school, yeah, I can look back at times where I would start yelling about something because I heard my parents yelling about it. Like, mm-hmm. It really shows you how these characters have come to be. And it's just such smart world building on Sarah's part. And I'm mm-hmm. just such a fan of it.
Yeah. I mean, as a playwright, I can tell how much work it must have taken and how many drafts she had to have gone through. Even if she did write the first one in 3 weeks and it was, you know, I don't know, only changed 2 or 3 times. those two or three times must have been ordeals, like getting it to this level, I imagine. Even if the time was short, well, it was because she was staying up all night. So
absolutely.
At least that's how I picture it must have been.
Yeah. No, I'm sure she went through like a lot of revisions.
Finally, the last question, which, you know, a lot of people have come to expect by now. Why do you believe that this play should continue to be read or performed?
Oh, there's so many ways I could answer this. I just feel like it's really cool to see a group of women working together on one show. And I think it's really different than any other script I've worked on personally. Like when I was working on the show, I remember in the beginning, all of us who were a part of it, like we were sort of trying to create alliances, and we were trying to like understand, you know, the power dynamics between the girls. And we were like trying to work towards an objective and like letting, you know, our ideas of these girls and their attitudes influence the way that we like performed these lines or whatever, right? Like there were so many things that got in the way of it. And I remember my director sat down with us and she was like, all right, ask this question that's in the script. And then we like just, you know, would ask the question. And she was like, that's what you need to do. Like, she's literally just asking a question. And I remember thinking that's so interesting because sometimes, you know, when you do a show or whatever it is, like you're trained to ask a question in a certain, right? Like you have to follow an objective and there's so many, and you have to have tactics and all this thing, all these things. And like the Wolves doesn't really operate like that. It's just a conversation.
Yeah.
And they really are just listening to each other and trying to like understand each other, and they're having fun, and it's a conversation. And I think that's really powerful to work on as an actor, to approach a script that is different than what you're used to working on. And it does let you understand story in a different way. You know, like every story and every play is going to ask something different from you. And that was something that I really learned working on this play. And it also was just a really empowering experience to work with all of my really great friends and create a show that we all really love together. And I just think it's really cool to see a structure like this. And I hope to see more people take on, you know, new structures and create it in their sort of way. And like, and I will say this too, I think that, the reason why this play should really like continue on as well is that like it really inspires you to create your own structures and to pursue your own way of storytelling. This story is really boring on its own, very boring, right? Like they're just talking about their lives and they're playing soccer and that's it. But the way that Sarah DeLapp shapes this play, the way that she tells this story, it's so freaking exciting to read and so cool to see on stage. And, you know, I think it really shows you, like, you can tell a story about anything. It could literally be the most boring thing that you're doing every day in your life, right? But, like, the way that you tell that story, that influences everything. So I think that's what's really important about this play and what's really significant about it is that, like, this play, if it was written in any other way, it would be really boring. But, like, Sarah DeLapp found the really exciting moments and she was able to create theater out of something that would be really conventional in another story. So I think that form is really essential, and I think this play really showcases that.
Yeah, heck yeah. I love that. Like, listen, I'm a sucker for form. I could talk about form all day long. I'm a student of multiple experimental playwrights. So like, I could probably go on and on about form all day. But you're right. I do hope more theater, but also just in general, people take up this idea that we can make something very profound and just entertaining out of everyday life. We don't have to be having some big event or whatever the hell for it to be worthwhile to perform and to watch and to work on.
Absolutely.
So even if you think your story is boring, I don't know, you can find a way to tell it that makes it not. I don't care what you want to write about. You can find a way to make it interesting. Definitely. Well, thank you for joining me today, Grace. It has been an absolute pleasure. And I've just really enjoyed talking to you about this play.
Thank you for having me. I love talking about this play. If anybody wants to talk about it, literally email me. I am ready at all hours. I could talk about this play for days.
Well, yeah, I can see here. I don't know if it anyone else can tell, because I'll probably be editing this, but we've been talking for almost an hour. So
yes,
just about this play. So she's telling the truth.
I'm like 100% serious. I just love it. I just love talking about it. It's so fun.
So if the people want to talk to you about it, or they just want to see more of your content and your work, where should they go to do that?
Yeah, so you can follow me on TikTok. My TikTok is at not Kristen Bell, because some people told me I look like Kristen Bell. You can decide if I do or not. Or you can visit my website, gracewalkerswebsite.com. I know, very clever. Thank you very much. And yeah, that's pretty much all. Oh, also Twitter at Grace Walker, 3 R's at the end. That's the same for my Instagram. I love social media. Please follow me. Thank you very much. I do follow back on Twitter.
On Twitter, right.
On Twitter.
Okay. Well, yeah, go over, follow Grace and all of the things and see what she's going to be up to next. Because pretty much everyone on this podcast, she's a multi-hyphenate. She's doing all sorts of crap. So go and check out and see what's coming up next. Once again, thank you so much for being here today, Grace. It's been a joy. No problem. And thank all of you out there for continuing to listen to this weird-ass podcast. if you want to contact me to recommend guests or plays that I should talk about on future episodes, you can email me at theplaymatespodcast@gmail.com. Or you can fill out our Google form on the podcast website that I need to update, playmatespodcast.weebly.com. Follow us on Instagram at Playmates Podcast to get vaguely consistent updates on the podcast. I have a job now, so things are weird. There's a little link tree in the bio where you can see the podcast website as well as my own personal website, links to how you can support the podcast if you would like, all that fun stuff. So feel free to check those out as well. I'm also on the TikTok if you're interested in that. I'm Librarian's Daughter, The Librarian's Daughter, some variation on that. I should probably know that better. You'll find me if you truly want to, I guess, if it is fated. So also please take a second, if you can, to write a good review and rate the podcast 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It means a lot to me. And it also helps other people to see the podcast, get it up more on the front page so people can actually take a look at it. Okie dokie. Huh. That is all for this episode. So I will see you all next time, where we will be discussing Dear Galileo by Claire Willette. Bye for now!